Hello, and welcome to Sobercast. We provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in a podcast format. We are an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into the virtual basket. Also, if you're a member of NA or have friends that are, please tell them about our other podcast, NAPOD. NAPOD features NA speakers and workshops in the same format as Sobercast. We upload a new speaker every day, and it's easy to subscribe by searching for NAPOD, N-A-P-O-D, all one word, on any podcast player app, or go to napod.xyz if you'd like to listen online. Hope you enjoy the podcast, and have a great day.
I don't want to take up any more of her time, and I ask you to join me in welcoming Gloria Deep from Long Beach, California.
Hi, I'm Gloria, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm glad to be here, and I want to thank everybody who made it possible for Bob and I to make this trip. I'm in love with the South, and this is our first trip to Kentucky. Now I'm in love with Kentucky. I think it's beautiful, and naturally, as far as I'm concerned, people with a Southern accent can say anything and make it sound good. And so I like being in a whole room full of people with Southern accents. Talking from the podium is not just my very favorite thing to do. As a matter of fact, I don't really like it. I love to be invited to speak because it makes me feel wanted, needed, and loved. But then it dawns on me about halfway here what I have to do when I get here, and I don't like that too much. But I'll do it. I know that there's something that God has something for me to say to somebody. Jimmy talked about that last night, about the man that told him that, and the same man told me that, it turns out, quite a few years ago, told Bob and I that we had a story to share, and that somebody needed to hear what we had to share. And I know that somebody in this room tonight needs to hear some experience that I've had, and so I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm here to share the fact with you that Alcoholics Anonymous works, and because of that, I don't have to drink anymore, and I don't have to run anymore, and I don't have to live on the streets in complete degradation and demoralization anymore. That's the way that I lived as a woman alcoholic. I was hopeless and helpless from the very beginning, and I didn't know it. I am one of those people that believe that I was born alcoholic. Doesn't matter whether I was born alcoholic or whether I crossed some invisible line and became alcoholic somewhere along the way. The solution is the same. And when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was told that we don't live in the problem. It doesn't matter how I became an alcoholic or why I became an alcoholic. Just what matters is what is the solution, and that we live in the solution in our program. And the solution for me is now and always has been, and I hope always will be, the things that are written about in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that that's where our program is. I believe that that's where I get my medicine, and I believe that if you're new here tonight, that's where you're going to get yours. I love the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the meetings, and I love getting together with AA people. Those are the only people I ever get together with. I don't have any life outside Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't want any life outside Alcoholics Anonymous. And I know that the program, the steps, as they're outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, are the thing, and in my own personal application of those steps in my life are the thing that give me what I have today. I can't just show up at meetings and smile and laugh and be happy and go on about my merry way and expect to have much growth in the program. And for me, I don't think I'll even have any sobriety without these steps working in my life. because they keep me connected to a power greater than myself, and they keep my eyes off of me somewhat as much as that's possible. And without those two things, I am dead, because I'm a very depressive person. I spent my life depressed before I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I spent my life looking at me and how sad I was and how pitiful I was and how horrible everything was for me and just poor me. And I deserve to drink, and there's no way out for me, and I was just depressed most of the time. I'm one of those people that has sort of periodic depressions, and I learned after I got sober that I had certain times in my life that were more, I was where I was more down than other times. And the fall, this time of year, ever since I can remember from my very earliest memories, this time of the year is when I always started feeling depressed. Those feelings, some kind of tuggings inside at my soul started happening to me, and I just feel sad and lonesome and homesick, and you know, I never get to this time of the year without being aware of that fact and being grateful, being aware of the fact that I don't have that anymore. And I just breeze right on into Thanksgiving and all of the stuff, and I can do fall now, and I don't have to be depressed, you know. I used to have to be real sad and get worse than I ever was, you know. My earliest memories of the way that I felt as a child were always my feelings were always, I was full of fear, always afraid of something, I don't know what, sometimes real stuff, and most of the time just imaginary things. I was an only child, and I had a lot of time to dwell on myself and how I felt, and I was born into an alcoholic home. My mother was an alcoholic, my father was an alcoholic, and he died of alcoholism when he was 34 years old, and I was 6 years old. And not too long after that time, my mother married another alcoholic. And so I knew about drinking, I knew about the things that go on in an alcoholic home. What I didn't know was that the people that lived there were sick. I thought that they were bad, and I thought that I was bad, and there was something wrong with me, and that I was responsible for the things that went on in that house, and I was ashamed. I was very ashamed. I'm one of those people that just seem to have been born guilty, and showing up at school was a painful experience for me. I went to a little church school. Before my father died, my mother promised him that she would send him to this church school. My father was Seventh-day Adventist, and my mother was Catholic. Neither one of them practiced any of this, but they liked to fight over what was I going to be. And anyway, I ended up going to this little church school, and my family sent me to this school, paid for me to go. And it was a small school. There were only 150 kids in the whole school, and we went from grades 1 through 8. And so in my class, there were always maybe 12, 13 kids. And we all knew each other. Everybody knew everything about each other. And those little girls, there came a time when the other little girls in my class weren't allowed to come to my house because word got around about the way that life was at my house. And I used to lie and try to make myself sound to these little girls like I lived like they did. I got tired of that, and I got to the point where I didn't want to have to lie and try to be like these little girls. And I got to a place when I was 11 or 12 years old where I made a couple of decisions. One of them was that if I can't be good, I'm going to be bad. It seemed like I was never going to be as good as those other kids. I was never going to have the kind of home they had. I was never going to be pretty and smart and all the things, have all the things that I thought these other little girls had. And I just decided that I just lost hope about the time I was 11 or 12 years old. And I decided that I wouldn't try to be like they were, that I would just forget about these girls and I would run around with the boys. And that's the way that I lived my life until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. My cousin he went to public school, and I thought that he was just very exciting just because he went to public school, and also because I thought he was a gangster. I told you I'm an only child, and I had a lot of time on my hands, and I spent a lot of time in the movies. I like to live in fantasy. Before I ever got a hold of alcohol and drugs to get me out, I just lived in any kind of fantasy I could live in, and movies helped a lot. I was in the movies a lot, and my favorite characters in the movies were always gangsters. I never fell in love with the guy with the white hat. It was always the guy with the black hat. And they were just exciting to me, and I always wanted to be one of those gun malls and dress and be in the nightclubs and have the furs and all the clothes and the gangster boyfriends. I never wanted to grow up and marry a doctor or a lawyer. I wanted to grow up and marry a gangster. And I liked them the best of all. And the sober ones in Alcoholics Anonymous are pretty exciting compared to... Anyway, this cousin of mine, as far as I was concerned, was a gangster. He ran around with a little gang of boys from this public school, and they stole hubcaps, and that was a big deal as far as I was concerned. And they wore leather jackets and had long hair, and they were gangsters. And I started hanging around with them, and they became my like brothers that I'd never had. They became my best friends, and they were my heroes. They were everything to me, and. The first time that I drank was the first time that I got drunk. I was 13 years old, and it happened to be Christmas Eve. Everything was going on in my house as usual that night. My mother was drunk and getting beat up. The difference was that it was Christmas, and there was no Christmas tree and no presents, and I was feeling especially sorry for myself that night. I always felt sorry for myself, but I was really feeling sorry for myself this night. And I used to spend a lot of time down on the corner in a little cafe. And I'd sit there night after night after night and talk to the old man who owned the place and just hang out there until I thought that everybody was passed out and it was safe for me to go home. And that's where I was this night. And some guys came along that I knew. They weren't my friends, the ones that I was used to hanging around, but I knew them slightly. And I ended up going for a ride with them. And they started drinking, and I started drinking with them. It just seemed perfectly natural for me to have a drink with them. I don't remember making any big decisions about it. This is good, bad, right or wrong. I certainly didn't think, well, this is just going to ruin my life. It was just automatic. I just started drinking. And I don't know how many I had that night before I began to experience a feeling that was to keep me in bondage for the next 16 years of my life. I got in a lot of trouble that night, and I experienced this feeling of I don't care. I just didn't care if it was Christmas. I didn't care if I was bad and crazy and wild like they said I was. I didn't care if my mother was getting beat up. I didn't care if it was Christmas. I cared about nothing. And the next day I came to, and I was in the back seat of an abandoned car, and I was in a strange town, and I was very sick, and I was very ashamed, and I was very guilty. And I was in more trouble than I'd ever been in my life, and I was an alcoholic. I know I can remember knowing someplace deep down inside me that morning that I had found something that would allow me to be somebody other than who I thought I was. And from that day on, I was willing to pay any price to experience that feeling. I was willing to pay any price to get a hold of something that I could put inside me that let me not think or feel or care. That's all I wanted. I wanted oblivion, and that's where alcohol took me. I'm a blackout drunk. I black out almost every time that I get drunk, almost every time I drink. I don't drink unless I get drunk. And I just don't drink unless I get drunk. If somebody just has a little half of something and they say, let's have a little drink, I don't drink that way because I know that I drink to get drunk. And I'm not one of these housewives who just sort of drinks along behind drawn drapes and does the ironing or just stays in bed. I used to wish to God that I was, but I'm just not that kind of drunk. For some reason, I put a drink of alcohol in me, and I'm on the move. And whatever comes into my mind is what I do, and I don't seem to have any control at all. I don't know anything about saying I won't drive a car tonight because I might get a 502. I won't go out tonight because I might get in trouble. I have said that many times, but it never seemed to work. When I take a drink of alcohol, I'm liable to end up anywhere with anybody doing anything. Anything can happen to me. I'm just like a leaf blowing in the wind. And that's the way that I started out drinking, and that's the way that I ended up drinking. It never got any different for me. So I left this church school, and I enrolled in public school, and I was very seldom ever there. I just hardly ever went to school after that. And I ran around with a crowd that was much older than myself. I always wanted to run with people that were older than I was, of course, because they had the alcohol and they did all these exciting things and they really knew how to be bad. They were unlike these little kids in this church school who are always trying to be good, and I couldn't keep up. And so I found myself in a lot of places doing a lot of things that 13, 14-year-old girls should not be doing, and seeing a lot of things that 13, 14-year-old girls shouldn't be seeing. And I took myself out of places, out of the church, out of my family's home. I took myself out of school. I took myself out of every halfway clean and decent place there was and put myself in the filthiest, dirtiest, sleaziest positions I could possibly put myself into because I felt that's where I belonged. When I was in those places doing those things, I felt like what I was didn't show so badly. And I had a boyfriend who was a longshoreman, and he used to take me down to the waterfront bars in a town right next to the town that I lived in. And we drank down on the docks, and when I had a drink of alcohol in me, I was afraid of nothing. I've run the streets down on those docks in those waterfront bars with all those kind of people you can imagine, the kind of characters that I ran into, and I was never afraid, never. But without a drink of alcohol, I was afraid to go out of the house. By the time I was 15 years old, I was completely out of control. I'd been in jail a lot of times. I used to run away from home regularly, and they used to lock me up and put me in juvenile hall for that, and just one thing and another. And I hated where I lived. I hated my stepfather. I hated having him tell me what to do. And I was ashamed of my mother, and I just hated everything. I hated me. I hated where I hated everything. And I wanted to be free. I thought I had this thing inside me. Something inside me made me feel like somebody was keeping me imprisoned all the time. And I wanted to be free, and I didn't want to have anybody to answer to. So I got this brilliant idea. I thought, well, I'll get married, and there'll be no one to answer to. Little did I know that husbands sometimes try to tell you what to do. And this one certainly was no different. I married an older man. He was 19 and I was 15. And I married this longshoreman that I've been seeing. And as soon as we got married, he wanted me to stay home and be Betty Crocker. And he wanted to go out and have all his fun in these waterfront bars. And I didn't like that idea, but I didn't think I had any choice in the matter. So I tried to do what he wanted me to do, and I tried to do what I thought housewives do. I didn't have a real normal home life, as you can imagine, so I didn't really know what normal stuff is in the home. All I had to gauge it by was what I saw on TV, you know, ladies in high heels and dresses mopping their kitchen floor, and that didn't... sure didn't work out very well. I couldn't keep up with any of that. And I was 16 years old, and like I said, I was afraid to go out of the house. I was afraid to go to the market in the afternoon because I just knew I'd be walking down the street, and I just knew that a car was going to run up on the sidewalk and run over me. I mean, I was just scared to death. I was scared to death in the house. I was afraid to walk by a door. I always knew somebody was hiding behind the door. I was just afraid all the time, unless I had something, unless I was under the influence of something. And I started using drugs as soon as I started drinking, too. And I just took whatever came along. It just didn't matter. They went hand in hand for me, and I was never long without one or the other or both. I just took everything with anybody, anywhere. And I stayed married to this man for 3 years. And towards the end of that marriage, I had a son, and one day I just picked him up and walked out, and I didn't give it a thought. I didn't think about what I was doing to my husband, what I was doing to my son, and least of all, what I was doing to myself. And that became my pattern. When things got uncomfortable for me, I just ran. And it didn't matter who I had to leave or who I had to run over or what I had to do, I just left when things got uncomfortable for me. And I took him and I went back to my mother's house. Seemed like a better place to be by this time than where I'd been. And I was there one night and I got thinking about this old friend of mine who ran around with this little gang of boys that I had grown up with. And I went over to see him, and that was Bob. And we started seeing each other every night after that. And it was good to be with him. And he seemed to like me just the way that I was. I know today that the name of that is love. I didn't know that then. He didn't try to regulate my actions. He didn't try to tell me don't drink so much or be quiet or don't do that or don't do this. He liked me just exactly the way that I was. And we just were together every night. And we liked doing exactly the same thing, which was absolutely nothing. We weren't big on hobbies or anything. Didn't have any interests. We just rode around in his car and just got drunk. That's it. And eventually, like he told you, he hocked his fishing pole for money for a marriage license. I got an annulment because we'd been married in Mexico, and we got married. And we started having children. I had this son by the first marriage, and then I had another son, and then I had a daughter. And life got to be a real hell for me and everyone concerned. I had no idea how to be a housewife, and I certainly had no idea how to take care of these kids. And I was guilty. Every day my guilt grew. Every day my shame grew. Every day my sense of panic grew. I had no idea how to take care of these kids, and I didn't want to raise my kids. I didn't want to have a home for my children that wasn't perfect. I wanted everything perfect. I had this unrealistic idea of what mothers are. I didn't think much about what a housewife is, but I had this dream, this idea of what a mother is, because I had this relationship with my mother that she loved me very much, and I knew it, and I loved her very much, and we were very close. My mother was very sick, and I just seemed to know that. And I wouldn't leave my mother. It didn't matter what the circumstances were. And I knew that if my mother didn't have to drink so much, that it would have been this way. You know, the idea that I had in my head. And I wanted to do that. I wanted to love my kids and do the things that I pretended that would have happened with me and my mother. And I couldn't do it. And it just drove me insane. And sobriety became impossible for me. I was totally and completely obsessed with alcohol from the very beginning, and I'm a bar drinker. I loved the bars. I loved drinking in the bars. I liked everything about the bars. I like dirty, filthy, rotten bars, and I like beautiful, fancy bars. It just didn't matter. I like the dirty, rotten, filthy ones the best because you can make more noise, and I'm a noisy drunk. And Bob hated the bars. And so, you know, we had a lot of trouble. And I used to think, if he would just settle down, if he just wouldn't get in so many fights and do all these things and go to jail all the time, I could drink, right? You know, I could drink. And I always blamed everything on him, and I blamed everything on my first husband. I blamed everything on my stepfather. I blamed everything on my mother. I blamed everything on everybody. I never learned to take responsibility for my own actions until I came to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank God I ran into some people here immediately who weren't afraid to tell me the truth. They weren't afraid of scaring me off. They weren't afraid of talking to me about God. They didn't think, oh God, let's soft pedal God and let's soft pedal this and let's soft pedal that because she might run off and get drunk. They weren't afraid of that. They knew that if I wanted sobriety, I was going to have to be presented the program of Alcoholics Anonymous just as it was, black and white. This is what we do, and this is what we don't do, and that's the way it was for me, thank God. And I was told that if I would learn to take responsibility for my own actions, that I would find a peace and a freedom within myself that I had never experienced before. And that I can pass that on to anybody who's new here tonight. If you haven't tried it, give it a try. They told me I could take the word blame out of my vocabulary. And thank God, because of those people that love me enough to tell me the truth, I don't have to be chained today to anybody because of hate and resentment. I've learned through the principles of the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and these people that went before me that I can take care of any painful situation in my life by seeing my part of it and doing what I have to do about it through the use of the 12 steps, and then I close the door and walk on. And I don't have to hate today. I don't have to blame today. And I'm peaceful and at ease in myself because of these things. I've been through a lot of painful situations in my sobriety that where it would have been so easy to just put the blame on somebody else. It would have been a lot easier to put the blame on somebody else, but I haven't had to do that, and so I don't have to carry the resentment and the hate for it. I don't have to have people that you know, I have to hide around the corner so that I don't have to see him because I hate him so much. Or because I think that they did something to me or that I did something to them. And it's a fabulous freedom. It's a fabulous freedom. I had to hide around corners and hide from people and look down to the ground my whole life because I always had somebody that I hated and I always had somebody that I was ashamed to see. And I don't live that way anymore because of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous working in my life. I didn't know what to do about these kids, and I started drinking. I started going on binges. I started staying away from the house for days at a time because I could not face getting up one more morning and having those kids there, and they were always hungry. You know, every morning they get hungry. And there they are, and you're sick, and you're ashamed. I was so ashamed. I mean, the life that I lived, whatever went on the night before was something that I didn't want to open my eyes to and face the next morning. And I had all of that going on in my head, all this guilt and all this shame and all this remorse. And then to have those kids there, and it just became, sobriety just became impossible for me. And I started staying gone from the house for days at a time. And I had heard about women that lost their kids. They would be proven unfit, and somebody would take their children. The courts would remove the children from the home. And I used to be gone from the house, and I hated myself so badly, and I felt so hopeless that I used to actually wish that that would happen to me. I used to actually wish that somebody would go and find out what was going on at my house and take these kids away and do something with them, take care of them, somebody. But that was never to be my experience. I always had to come home, and I always had to face my husband and the look in his eyes, and I always had to face my children and the look in their eyes, and I always had to face myself, worst of all. And I'd have to ask myself once again, what is it that keeps driving me out of the streets time after time after time and doing these things when I said I wouldn't do it anymore? I didn't want to hurt these people. But I didn't seem to have any control, and I didn't know. I just didn't know. Used to be a man, he's dead now, but he was in our area, and he used to say there's no such thing as good or bad people, just those who know and those who don't know. And it was so soothing and so healing for me to hear him say that when I was newly sober, because I just certainly didn't know, and I didn't know that I didn't know. I just thought I was bad. And eventually, my husband and I left my kids with my mother-in-law. I told her I was going to go find Bob and everything would be okay. And I found him, and we were in a lot of trouble, and we did a lot of things. And we ended up riding around California and Oregon on a Greyhound bus and staying in rescue missions and Salvation Armies. I know what it's like to beg for a grocery order, go to a St. Vincent de Paul or a Salvation Army and try to beg for a meal, try to get a bag of beans someplace for my kids. This was before we left. I know what it's like to sell my blood for a drink. I know what it's like to have to just try to beg someplace so that you can just get a drink so that you don't have to think or feel or care. I know what it's like to be a helpless, hopeless alcoholic. I know about degradation and demoralization. I know about shame, and I don't want to ever have to learn any more about it, believe me. I don't ever want to have to go back out on the streets and live as an alcoholic woman, live the life that I lived before. I believe that my sobriety is a gift from God, and I believe that there are things that I have to do to take care of my sobriety. And I am so very grateful today for the feeling of being clean inside that I have this very minute standing in front of you. I'm not ashamed of anything in my life, and it's so wonderful to feel this way at long last. And I was given this gift in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know that there are things that I have to do to take care of this gift, and I remain willing today to do whatever it is that I have to do. If it's fly to Kentucky and stand up and talk from a podium when I don't want to talk from a podium, I'd be glad to talk on a one-to-one basis. But talking from a podium is just uncomfortable for me. But I will do that if it's doing whatever I have to do. If it's sweeping the floor after the meeting, if it's whatever I have to do. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous really doesn't ask anything that's all that horrendous. You know, life at Alcoholics Anonymous is sure a lot easier than life on the streets as a drunk, I'll tell you that. Those of us who've been out on the streets, or life in a penthouse apartment as a drunk. Life as a drunk anywhere is very hard. and very uncomfortable. I know there are people in this room who have never lived the life that I have lived. They've never experienced the experiences outwardly that I've experienced, but I know from my time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know from other people sharing with me that as alcoholics, we've all experienced the same feelings. And that is where we get our understanding and our love one for another. The thread that runs through Alcoholics Anonymous that sews us all together is this understanding, one drunk talking to another. You know where I'm coming from, I know where you're coming from, and it doesn't matter if you just got terribly ashamed pouring milk at school for your children at the PTA meeting, or whether you were out there doing what I was doing, you experienced the same shame that I did. And that was another freedom for me to find that out when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, because I thought I was the worst person that ever walked through the door, and I know that's just ego in reverse now. I know that we all have experienced the same degradation, and that's what makes it possible for us to practice these steps. That's the price we paid for sobriety, and we practice these steps, and we fill these chairs at meetings, and we do what we have to do, and we perpetuate the program of Alcoholics Anonymous because we're grateful. I believe that gratitude is an action word. I believe that it's easy to stand at the podium of Alcoholics Anonymous and talk about being grateful, but it's another thing to get up in the middle of the night and go sit with a drunk. It's quite another thing to drive across town and go to an institution and talk to people, or carry the literature someplace, or do one thing and another. That's how we show our gratitude in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Being secretary of a meeting and showing up week after week after week when it's raining or when it's cold or when there's nobody there or when everybody else gets to go over there and I still got to show up here and put the dumb coffee up and, you know, do all the stuff. That's when my gratitude shows. And anyway, I'm getting way off the track. We stayed gone for a couple of years, and we got back to Long Beach finally, and by this time he'd become a cook and I'd become a waitress. And 19 years ago today, we were working in this little truck stop on the west side of Long Beach. And I was so sick that I could barely get up out of bed every day. And we didn't drink before we went to work, and we didn't take anything before we went to work because we knew that we'd never go to work. And by this time, we were just two shaking, sick little wino bums living in a little wino hotel. And by God, we knew that we were not slick anymore. We couldn't put it over on anybody anymore. We had to go show up at this little job and get some money, or else we couldn't have a drink. And according to how many tips I made that day, that's what we did when we got off work that night. And I'd be so sick, and I'd be pouring a cup of coffee, and I just wanted to throw up on whoever I was serving. I was just sick to death and shaking, and I'd go back in the back room for some consolation from Bob, and he'd be out in the kitchen sitting on a milk crate with his head in his hands, just sick to death. And we just, you know, just trying to make it through the day so that according to how much money I had that day, from tips, then that's what we'd do that night. Sometimes we'd just get a bottle of wine and go to this little room. Sometimes we'd go to a bar and drink. Sometimes we'd go over to a friend's house and get some heroin and shoot that. It just didn't matter what it was. Or it just, whatever we had to do. And that's the way that I was existing at the very end. And Bob went to jail, and he'd been gone to jail a lot of times before, and this time it was going to be different. This time I wanted to show him that I could be grown up and I could take care of myself and I could be good. I wanted badly, desperately to show him that I could be good and I wouldn't do anything to hurt him again. And this time it was going to be different. I was going to keep my job and I wasn't going to drink and I was going to do things right. And that lasted for about a week, and I came in one night and I wanted a drink, and when I wanted a drink, I took a drink. And when I took a drink, I started running, and that's exactly what happened. I ran into some people that I'd known a long time before in a bar, and they were robbing stores and using heroin, and that's what I started to do with them. Before long, I found myself driving the car for these robberies night after night and living a life of total fear and total confusion and degradation. And I never went out of this place until the sun went down. And then it was only to go and get some money and then go get the dope and then come back to this room that I lived in. And it was just black, and it was a pit. It was hopeless. There was no way out of there for me. No way. I should have died there laying on that bed. So many days, so many nights, I should have just been dead. They should have just found me laying there dead. But that isn't what God had in store for me. God wanted me to come to Kentucky one day and shake through this deal. God. I got arrested for these things, and they kept me 3 days, and then they let me go because they didn't have enough evidence to hold me. I just drove the car, and nobody could identify me, and they let me go after three days, and I didn't have any place to go. It had been years since my family would have anything to do with me. By this time, my mother was dead, and everybody that would have anything to do with me was locked up in jail, and the rest of my family, the other part of my family wouldn't have anything to do with me. So I didn't know where I was going to go or what I was going to do, and I thought of my first husband. And I called him up, and I told him that the situation I was in, and told him I needed a place to stay. And he said I could come over if I didn't cause any trouble. And I really thought that took a lot of nerve on his part, since this was all his fault. I told you, I always had somebody to blame. Anyway, I went over there to his place, and there was all I wanted to drink. And I started pouring down bottle after bottle after bottle. That's the way I drank. I drank whiskey out of the bottle. I loved to drink whiskey out of the bottle. I did not. If you're new here tonight and you think I stopped drinking because I developed an aversion to it, I did not. I loved drinking whiskey until the very end. And I used to carry the empty bottles around in my purse just for, it gave me a sense of security or something. I don't know what. But there was bottle after bottle. I poured it down. I don't know how long I was there. I don't know what happened while I was there. I just know that finally the thing happened to me that I believe happens to every alcoholic who's ever given the gift of sobriety, and that was that it just simply didn't work for me anymore. No matter how much I drank, it didn't take me to oblivion. It didn't turn off the pictures. It didn't turn off the nightmares. It didn't turn off the shame and the fear and the guilt anymore. I had become powerless over alcohol. I could no longer pick up a drink and be sure that it would do for me what it had always done. It did not take me to oblivion. And naturally, I kept on drinking. And one day I came to, and I was yellow, and I knew I had hepatitis. I'd had it twice before. And the doctors told me that if I ever got it again, I'd die. And I thought I was dying. And I laid on the bed in this apartment. It was a filthy, dirty apartment. And I didn't come out of there when I heard people, couldn't show my face. And when I didn't hear anybody, then I could come out. And nobody peeked their head in to see if I was dead or alive. By this time, my oldest son lived over here, over in this place with his father. It was better to be there than with me. And that's kind of the way that I was able to pick out a sobriety date for myself. I was laying on this bed one day, and I don't know how many days it had been since I'd been sick and hadn't. I just couldn't drink. I couldn't get any more down. I just laid there on this bed. And one day I heard voices out in the other room, and they started singing. And they were singing Happy Birthday, and I realized they were singing Happy Birthday to my son. And I was too sick and too ashamed and too helpless to get up off of that bed and wish my own child a happy birthday. That's the kind of humiliation that brought me to this program. That's the kind of humiliation that keeps me in this program. Those are the kinds of things, the kinds of surrenders. It wasn't driving the getaway car. It wasn't going to all those jails. It wasn't doing all those things. It was those kinds of things that just made my skin crawl to know that I was completely and totally powerless and completely and totally helpless to take part in any kind of life, to be any kind of a mother to my children. And not long after that, my ex-husband told me that he'd send me to Harbor General Hospital in a cab. And so Harbor General Hospital is a county hospital, and that's the way it had to end for me. I was driving to a county hospital alone in a taxi cab to die. I knew that I was going there. That I really thought I was going there to die. I was sick, and I knew that I couldn't go much longer. And I thought on the way up to that hospital that I was going to die, lay there and die the way my mother had died. And she died in that very same hospital of the disease of alcoholism. And I happened to be sober at that time, and I was with her day and night. And I remembered then, and I remember now, what it looked like, a woman dying of our disease. And she was terrified, absolutely terrified, and her the indignity of the whole thing. She was ashamed, and they didn't even bother to dress her at the end. And she just screamed out and asked me if she was going to die, and I didn't know what she, I didn't know. And I knew that I was going there to end up that very same way as she did. And I stood in the waiting room of Harbor General Hospital. I had on a pair of black Levi's that I'd been wearing for a couple of months. I had on a man's shirt. My hair was long and stringing down. I was bright yellow. I weighed about 98 pounds. I was just skin and bones. I was 29 years old, and it was over for me. It was over. And I didn't even have an address to put down on the admitting form. And they did a biopsy on my liver, and the doctor told me that the results showed that my liver was so badly damaged that I wouldn't live over 3 years if I kept on going the way I was going. And I wouldn't live over 5 even if I didn't drink or use any drugs again. And so I laid awake that night thinking about dying. I always thought that's what I wanted. I thought I wanted out. And as I look back on it in sobriety, I realized that was just some more self-pity on my part. That night, when it got right down to it, when I really thought that I was going to die, I became very desperate to stay alive. I remembered that night in that hospital room, the things that my grandmother told me happened to little girls like me when they die. And I was terrified. I was scared to death of God. I didn't want to have anything to do with God. I knew that I was bad, and I knew I deserved the very worst. And I thought, if I get his attention on me, if I ask him for anything and get his attention on me, I am really going to get it. And so I just thought, I won't bother him, and he won't bother me. I had this childish idea of God, this childish, fearful idea of God. And but that night I was so desperate, I was so terrified, that I started talking to God alone in that hospital room. And I asked him for just one thing that night, and that was, just please let me stay alive. I just wanted to keep on breathing, not for any honorable reasons, but just simply because I was afraid to die. And I had what I believe to have been a spiritual experience that night. I think that we all have spiritual experiences more often than we realize. I think every time I see a little bit of truth about myself, I feel that my spirit awakens a little bit. And I believe that's a spiritual experience. And that's what happened to me that night. I saw some truth about myself for the first time in my life, maybe. And the next morning, the doctor came into my room, and he had a big smile on his face, and he was just cheerful and joyful as he could be, and he said, well, you're not going to die. He said, we've made a mistake. That shows you how much we know about the human liver. Ha, ha, ha. And he just thought it was great, and I thought, God, I've spent my night reforming, and this guy's made a mistake. Today, I know it wasn't a mistake. I know that it was the hand of my God just pushing me a little closer to a place where I could surrender when the program of Alcoholics Anonymous came my way. I know that that he doesn't make mistakes, and that's exactly what happened. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous came my way. It came to me. He walked into my room and sat down in a chair next to my bed and started talking to me. That's how it happened. I had seen Alcoholics Anonymous many times in my life. My mother used to try to go to AA and get sober. And I used to have a friend, she's been sober many, many years now, but her daughter and I were friends, and we used to go to AA meetings with her. And my husband and I went to AA meetings a few times, and one time he got some sort of a drunk driving or something, and somebody took us to meetings, and of course I didn't hear anything. All I knew about AA was that there were a lot of smiling faces there, and they seemed to have fun. I used to love it when I was a kid, and my mother, I could go with my mother. But I knew nothing about Alcoholics Anonymous, and I certainly was not in the market for Alcoholics Anonymous at this point in my life. Sobriety was the farthest thing from my mind. I was sober quite a few weeks before I knew I was getting sober. And that's just the way that it had to be. It had to kind of sneak up on me. I stayed in this hospital for a while, and then they moved me to Long Beach to another hospital called El Cerrito Hospital. And the Harbor Area Institutional Committee had a couple of meetings there during the week. And he was a patient in that hospital, and he just kept coming to my room. And he was a new member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know how they are. They want to save the world. And he was out to save me. And I just couldn't get rid of him. I just couldn't get rid of him. So finally, just to set him up, I went to an AA meeting with him. And
I sat around a table of, I don't know, maybe 8-10 people, and much like yourself, they had the same look in their eye. Everybody used to look like they had a secret. All AA people look like they had some secret and a mischievous little look in there, some deep something in there, and I liked it, and I wanted it. And they smiled and they hugged me, and it was warm and it was safe and it was gentle, and I hadn't been any place like that for many, many years. And I didn't hear anything in those first few meetings. I just kept going back to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous for exactly the same reason that I kept going back to alcohol, and that was that I just liked the way that it felt. I just simply liked the way that it felt there. And I'd go and they'd give me the cake. These two little old men were the secretaries, and each one of them had it, were secretary of the two meetings a week, and they'd send me back to my room with extra cake and cigarettes and one thing and another, and people would pat me and they'd say, "You're gonna be okay, honey. You're gonna make it. You're gonna be alright." And sometimes I would just cringe and I'd think, "God, how can they say something like that to me? If they only knew, what I am, how bad I am, how could they have any faith in me?" And today I look back on it and I know it wasn't me that they had faith in. They were members of Alcoholics Anonymous and their lives had been restored. They were sober through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was a program that they had faith in. They were telling me, "If you stay close to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you're going to be okay. You're going to be fine. You're not going to have to drink anymore." And that's what I say to you tonight. Those of you who are new in this room, you just stay close to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't have to drink anymore if you don't want to. And people started telling me things, and I began to hear things in those meetings. One of the things was maybe the most important thing I've ever heard in my life. It was a thing that I believe opened up the gates of hell and let me out and allowed me to become a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was, somebody told me that I was not bad, that I was sick. They said Alcoholics Anonymous is not a place where bad people come to get good. It's a place where sick people come to get well. And they told me that I could get well if I would do the things that are outlined in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. And they told me that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a place for those who need it. It's a place for those who want it. And they said all I had to do was want it, and I could have it. And I don't know when I began to want it. I don't know when I began to want sobriety, when I developed this desire, when I was given the gift of sobriety, this desire to not take the next drink. I just know that when it got time for me to leave the hospital, I didn't want to go. And the reason that I didn't want to go was that I knew I'd go back out and live the way that I'd been living. I knew I'd go back out and drink, and I didn't want to do that. It had happened. The miracle had happened, and I hadn't even asked for it. I hadn't even looked for it. It just came, just from a very loving God to a nothing. I was empty inside and out. And just because of God's grace, I'm standing here tonight. A woman, a grown woman, whole and clean and able to live up to the commitments that I've made to my own self in this program. I've made a lot of commitments to a lot of people in this program, and I'm able to live up to them today. I'm able to be dependable, but the most important thing to me is I live up to my own commitment to me. I live up to my own standards. I live up to the things that I always wanted to live up to as a little girl, when I thought I want to do this and I want to do that, and the desires of my own heart are mine today. And I don't have to be trashed out on the street anymore. I don't have to look down at the sidewalk and hope that nobody sees me anymore. I don't have to walk in shame today. I walk with my head up and I look anybody in the eye. And I'm a lady today. They told me that if I would act like a lady, I'd be treated like a lady in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's true. It just so happens that's true. I've always been treated with respect and loved very well in this program. I knew there were some things that I didn't want to do anymore, and I haven't had to do them, not one time. I knew, number one, I never wanted to hurt my husband again the way that I had hurt him in our drunkenness, and I've never had to do that. Number one, I never wanted to hurt him. And that's the way that we live today. We're able to be good to each other. And we live in a clean home, and things are peaceful around us and beautiful. And it's a fabulous life today, just because of a very, very simple program called Alcoholics Anonymous, just because of 12 principles working in my life today. That's the difference. They've come in and replaced the thing that allowed me to live all those years, the thing that I thought I needed to live so desperately. That's been removed from me, and in its place, God gave me a program called Alcoholics Anonymous to live by. One of the men who was secretary of this meeting told me that there was a place in Long Beach called the House of Hope. He said it's a woman's recovery house. And he said women live there and they go to AA meetings and they live and get better and then go on about their business. And I had never heard of such a thing. My father died in bed in our apartment. My mother called all night trying to get a doctor to come and help him, and nobody would come. And I didn't know that there were places like that for people like me to get well. And I know that I was in a state of surrender also to even that, because I even considered going to live in a house full of women. I hated women. I hated women. And I didn't want to have anything to do with women. However, I was desperate. And I want to just say, in case I forget, that I have learned, I've been given many, many gifts in this program, one of them being a love for the alcoholic woman. And I even love Al-Anon women today. Can you imagine that? I don't have to be afraid of any woman that I encounter. That's what it was. It was fear. I knew that that I was nothing, and you all were everything. You all were everything there was, and I was nothing. And today I don't feel that way about myself. I'm filled up today, and I'm at peace with my own womanhood. And I know that I have my deals, and you have yours, and it's okay. I don't have to want yours. You know, wish I had yours. I'm satisfied with mine. Whatever my gifts are, that's good. I'm glad. I'm glad that I have some gifts today. I'm glad that I can recognize those gifts today, and I know that they're a gift from God. My sponsor, Norma, told me that that everything good that came into my life was a gift from God. Everything. And that's the truth. Everything that I have today is a gift from God. It's nothing that, this is not a self-improvement course we're involved in here. This is not like Dale Carnegie or John Robert Powers, you know. I haven't learned how to do all these things here. We're not in a self-improvement course. This is our life. I am doing these things that I'm told to do in this program because I got to stay alive, and for me a drink is to die. And along the way, as fringe benefits, I got all these other gifts, all these other blessings, and so will you. So will anybody in this room who works for them. In the promises, after the promises in the book, it says that these things will come if we work for them. All these promises will come if we work for them. When I don't work for them, I don't get them. It's just as simple as that. I half measures avail us nothing. I got into this recovery house. I knew that I was never going to be accepted. They told me about this recovery house, and I knew that I'd get there and I'd have to answer questions, and they'd know what I was and where I'd been, and they'd never let me live there with all those other nice ladies. Well, I was happily surprised because I got to the house for this interview with this house mother, and she happened to be sick in bed that day, and she was perched up on her bed. She's kind of a cute little lady, and she always wore bright colors, and she had shocking pink curtains hanging in her room, and she burned incense and candles all the time, wore a lot of jewelry. And I had a whole other idea about ladies who live like that in places like that. And I learned a lot from that lady. And I sat across the room from her, and she said, "Do you want to come and stay with us, honey?" And I said, "Yes, I do." And she said, "Okay, you can move in tomorrow." Just like that. Nobody asked me how much money I had, where I'd been, where I was going, nothing. It was simply a matter of if I wanted to be there, I was welcome. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous ever since. I am accepted with open arms. And I moved into that house, and I began to learn a lot of things. We had meetings. Every morning we studied the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in that house. And throughout the week, women would come and visit. And we had AA meetings, women's meetings in that house. And I began to meet the women in the community that were AA members, and they'd come and share themselves, and it was a fabulous experience for me. I know some women have been through recovery houses, and maybe they didn't like them. I loved it from the very beginning. Believe me, where I'd been compared to what I'd had, it was heaven. It was paradise, and I'll never forget the feeling of laying my head down on the pillow at night for the first time in many, many years, and knowing that I hadn't done anything to hurt anybody that day, and I hadn't done anything to hurt myself or humiliate myself, and I started to feel clean just by association with the people in Alcoholics Anonymous. I hadn't even got anywhere yet. I hadn't even begun to work for these things, and I was already beginning to reap the benefits of sobriety, the benefits of the program. It was a fabulous experience for me. I began to meet people. Norma, I met in the recovery house. I'm not going to be able to say too much about this, or else I won't be able to talk at all. And she just looked like an angel to me. And she said that she'd been in some situations that I've been in, and I believed her. I didn't believe anybody. I didn't believe anything anybody told me. Nothing. I believed in nothing. I didn't want to feel anything. I shut down many years before this. And all of a sudden, I believed that this lady had been in these places and felt the same kind of degradation that I had. And I believed that it looked to me like she just shared these things with me in love and that she wasn't ashamed anymore. And I began to have hope that maybe I could be like that someday. And she told me that I could, if I would do the things in the book Alcoholics Anonymous, that I could be clean and I wouldn't have to drink anymore. And that's the truth. Sure enough, here I am. In January it'll be 19 years and I haven't had to do any of those things. And life just gets better and better and better. She told me it was going to get better and better and better. And I mean, things had happened and I'd say, how can it get any better than this? You know, when we got the phone, or when we got an apartment, or, you know, we got a coffee pot, you know. How can it get any better than this? And she just would smile and say, it's going to get better and better and better, and it has. Oftentimes, it looks like it's getting worse. Oftentimes, it feels like it's getting worse, but it's constantly getting better. Sometimes, it looks like life is falling apart, and it's actually falling together. I have learned that much. If I haven't learned anything else, I've learned to just hang in there, and stand still and hurt. That used to be my worst thing. I used to think, what are they talking about? Stand still and hurt. Anybody knows all you have to do is just take a step or something, and you don't have to stand still and hurt. And I used to tell Norma, and we'd get so mad. People, she was sober a year and a half, I guess, when I got sober, and I thought she'd been sober longer than God, you know. And so we had some of the same beliefs about things, about how other people should work their program. I started writing letters to my husband, and he wrote back and told me that he was sober. And so for both of us to find the program together was miraculous. And life got to be very exciting. I actually got excited about living. I got excited about life. I actually looked forward to the day. And I actually looked forward to getting up in the morning and finding out what we were going to read in the book. I was excited about life, just life, simple life, just being sober, just being in this house, finding out who I was going to meet at these meetings every night, and I'd see the same people, and it was a fantastic experience for me. And I got on a cloud that was so high that everybody, they all were telling me, look out, you're gonna get too healthy, too wealthy, and too wise, and you're gonna fall off of that cloud, and don't get too happy, and blah, blah, blah. And Norma told me I could be as happy as I wanted to be. She told me to enjoy my sobriety. And, I'm still up there. I'm still enjoying it. Believe me, I've had a lot of painful days, but because of this high that I experienced in the program, I'm able to go through the days where I just want to just cut my wrist or something, you know. From the very beginning in this program, I have been given this hope, got lit up inside me. I have been recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I've never been without hope again since I got to this program. Someplace along there in the beginning, I was given hope, and it's never gone away, regardless of what's been going on in my life. And I'm just like all the rest of you. I've had some of everything that life has to offer in sobriety. I've had my share of pain, my share of joy, my share of excitement, all of those things. My share of mediocrity, days that just kind of hum along and it's like, God, somebody do something, you know? And my share of everything. Those are the worst days. You know, you can't sink your teeth into anything. Just middle ground. Actually, I don't know whether it's chronological age or sobriety age, but I am getting so that I look forward kind of to those days. They used to talk about balance in all these meetings, and I think balance, you know, I had a real flippant saying, imbalance is my balance, and, you know, I just thought, oh, you know, you can't just just breathe in here off the streets, living the way that I lived, and just become easy homemaker overnight. And that didn't happen for me. I'm sorry to say, if I have a regret in my sobriety, it's that. I wish that I could have done something to make everything perfect in my home, but I couldn't. I was a very sick, sick woman. And thank God for the women in this program who told me that I was sick and that I was doing the best I could on a daily basis, and if I could do any better, I would do it. I know some ladies come here and they get their home together and they cook and they clean and they take care of their children and they join the BGA and do all those things, and I couldn't do that. I just simply couldn't do it. My husband came home from jail and we got a little apartment out in the alley behind the house. I hope they just don't get too far away, so we didn't get too far away. And life just began to grow. He got a job, and I was about 8 months sober, and he said it was time for our children to come home. And my mother-in-law said it was just a long time past overtime for my children to come home. And I said that I wasn't ready. I'm glad nobody waited for me to get ready, or they never would have got home. I never thought that I was capable of taking care of these children, drunk or sober, and I just didn't think I could do it. And I told her, I said, I'm not going to be able to do this and stay sober. And she told me that you can do anything as long as you keep Alcoholics Anonymous number one in your life. You can do anything. And so there we went. And I don't ever want to forget the day that Bob and I went and picked up my oldest son didn't come home until he was about 18 years old, but we went and picked up our daughter and our son from my mother-in-law's house. And we had gotten a new apartment then, and we'd gotten these little beds and seats and everything. I mean, just like real, you know. And we brought these little kids home. We had this Falcon that he told you about, and they were in the back seat, and we were going to start out. And believe me, I did not think, I had no illusions that this was going to just be wonderful, wonderful. I didn't think I could do it, but I was going to do it because she told me I could do it. And I had Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wanted to stay sober. And we rounded the corner and pulled up in front of this place, and this little girl that was 6 years old, or that was 6 years old at the time, her brother was eight. She had nothing in her life. Her and her brother and their grandmother, and their grandmother was drunk all the time. They'd never had a thing. They wandered up and down the alley in dirty, filthy clothes. I mean, they had nothing. But they had each other, and she clung to her brother that day and started screaming and crying. She didn't want to come with me. She didn't know me, and I didn't know her, and I was ashamed. Once again, I was ashamed, and I was afraid. And I don't ever want to forget that day, because I don't ever want to have to experience those kinds of feelings again. We went in the house, and we got started in life, and I had to go to meetings. I guess I went to meetings every night, and thank God for my mother-in-law. I don't know where any of us would be if it hadn't been for her watching these kids, but we got started on life, and sure enough, the day came when I got to where I could maintain some kind of balance in this house, and there were many, many days when I just stood there. If there's any women in this room tonight and you think that you're never going to be able to make it, you're never going to take care of these kids, you're going to have to just leave them someplace, believe me, you can stay sober and you can do what you have to do. I had days when I just stand there and I just think, God, I can't make it, but I didn't want to drink and I knew that I couldn't run away from this and stay sober. And believe me, some days that's the only thing that kept me going. It certainly wasn't this wonderful, overpowering feeling of motherhood or this love for my children, because I had to learn to be able to allow myself to love these children. And I used to feel so guilty about that. And there came a day when I was maybe 8 or 9 years sober. It took me a long, long time. I had all my children around me for the first time in a long time. By this time, my son had ran away from home and been gone for a long time. And he came over. It was Christmas, Easter vacation. I had my oldest son there, and they were all standing around me. And I never forget this day. I was standing at the sink, and I was doing something. And they were all, I was aware of the fact that they were all standing there by me. And by this time, they were all pretty big kids. And I was at peace. I wasn't panicky. I didn't want to say, hey, go out in the other room, or go down to the park. I just stood there and felt the feeling. I just stood there and received the love that these children were having for one another, and the love that they were having for me, and the love that I was having for them. I loved them. Of course I loved them all along. It's a God-given instinct. And I had it all along, but I refused to feel it. I refused to accept that feeling. And I learned to accept love, receive love, feel love, in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous from you. You loved me, and I learned little by little to begin to receive that love. And it finally spread into these children. I wasn't afraid to love them anymore. And I wasn't afraid that they were going to disappear. I became the same way with my husband. I got to a place where I could love him 100%. I could feel my feelings for him 100%. And I didn't have to be afraid that he was just going to disappear. And we ended up, my learning to be a mother came mostly with my daughter, because she was the only one left at home. And she and I became best friends. And I to this day would rather spend time with her than any other woman I know. And we are very good friends today. And we were good friends when she was a kid. She's sort of a grown-up kid. She was born grown-up. She had to be grown-up. And we did everything. In case there's anybody here that's keeping their child busy so that they'll be normal, believe me, you can save yourself a lot of energy. I'm not the creator. I thought that I could make this girl what I wanted her to be. And she was in every class, every modeling class, every school, everything. We gave her every lesson there was. God, I spent all my time driving her to and from. And she was perfect. She was perfect. And until she was about 16 years old. And she just spent all her free time with us, and we'd go out, and it was wonderful. And she started coming in drunk. And I told my husband one night, I said, I can't do this again. I simply can't do this again. I'd already been through years of jails and grotesque situations with my son. And I couldn't do it again. And in the back of my head was a little voice saying, you can do anything if you keep the program of Alcoholics Anonymous number one. And I did. Many nights I spent laying awake worrying about these kids, wondering if they were going to be dead or alive. I had to get to a place where I knew that it was possible that they were going to die on the street drunk. I had to get to that place. I couldn't just go on the idea of, well, they're going to be sober any minute, because it went on and it went on and on, and I had to know they may just die drunk, and that's all there is to it, and I'm going to have to go on. Thank God, nobody promised me that anybody else was going to get sober. They promised me I would be sober. If I practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, if I live these steps in my life, I'm going to be sober. And that's all anybody ever promised me. And as it turned out, she went on, she was living in her car by the time she was 19 years old, and we had to go through all of these things. And I know we haven't gone through anything more than any other parents in this room he's gone through, and that's just the way that it was. And Bob and I, through all of this, were able to be together and stand firm together and live this program together and go to meetings. And I was able to go to meetings and laugh and carry on. I mean, I'm a very active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was a very active drunk, and I'm a very active sober drunk. And I could go to meetings and laugh and do my thing and go to conventions, and it was like medicine. It was like a safe place for me to be in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, Norm Alpie's gone now. He used to talk all the time, and I remember him saying they laugh when they're sad and they cry when they're happy, and they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And that just about says it. That's the way it was for me. People have asked me, do you just laugh all the time? Are you just happy all the time? No, I don't laugh all the time, and I'm not happy all the time. I mean, inside there's always, of course, this real happiness, but I mean, I'm not just up all the time. But I have this joy that just comes over me when I'm in a room full of people from Alcoholics Anonymous. That's just the way that it is. It always has been that way, and I hope to God it always is. I hope I can always go into a room full of people from Alcoholics Anonymous and experience that joy and that shelter from whatever thing it is. Anyway, there came a day when all three of our children became members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today we've got all these kids, three of them, all sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they're good members of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm proud of them. I'm proud of the way they conduct themselves in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have a perfect respect for them, and they have respect for me and for their father. They've always treated me with respect, and it didn't have to be that way. They've never once thrown anything up in my face. They've never talked to me disrespectfully, drunk or sober, and I don't know why. I just guess that's just something, just part of God's plan for us. And I'm so proud of them today, and I'm so grateful. We don't just all sit around the dining room table on a daily basis and talk about the 12 golden steps to recovery. It's not quite that Ozzie and Harriet yet. But they're around, and I know they're around, and we share meetings together, and it's a beautiful thing. And we've got our granddaughter was born a year ago, last Thursday, and that's something else again, you know. I find myself keeping her kind of at arm's length because I loved that little girl before she was ever born. The minute my daughter, I was the first one that my daughter told that she was pregnant. And I felt a feeling that I've never felt before. And she did too. I could see her loving this child. I never saw anybody pregnant, going to give birth, sober, and doing all the right things. And the feelings that you feel, it's just a wonderful thing. But you know, I'm like they say, I'm overpaid. I mean, how could did I? You know, I have I done anything to get this? This gift? Have I done anything to live in this grace? No. I just have a God that loves me that I've been given here in Alcoholics Anonymous. A God that you introduced me to in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. The 12 steps led me to this God, and he just came here and loved me. And it's the same for every alcoholic and every member of Al-Anon, everybody sitting in this room. God loves us equally well, and God blesses us equally well. And that's just the way that it is, and aren't we blessed? What a power it is that could bring me from a dirty wino hotel room to the place that I am standing tonight. There's just no way. It's just an impossibility. And here I am. I can you know, people in Long Beach, people that knew me when I first got sober can tell you I can't talk at the podium. I can't say my name without crying. And all of a sudden, here I am, and I'm just rattling on and on. And, you know, I may shed a few tears, but I'm able to stand here and talk. And I can't do that. I can't live in reality. I can't face life on life's terms. I can't love. I can't live without drinking. And here I am today doing all of these things. I have a peace within that is mine. And nobody can take it away from me. God gave it to me through the people of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's my very own gift, and I have it, and I can always go there through any situation. There's a little quiet place inside that I can go and experience this peace. I spent a lot of time by myself today, and I like it that way. I can just talk to my God, or I can think about you, and I can think about when I go home, I'll be alone, and I'll be thinking about this place, and I'll see your faces, and it'll be one more thing. That I have another memory that I have to treasure, another thing to keep me warm on a night when maybe it's getting cold outside, you know. And we all have that benefit. We all have that blessing to share. When I was new, I used to shop in junk stores a lot, and I found a wooden plaque one day, and I've had it hanging in my house ever since I found it. I don't know what it meant to the person that threw it away, but it means very much to me. It's got some keys painted on it. And it says the keys to the kingdom. And it reminds me of that place in the book that says now there's a sense of belonging, of being wanted, needed, and loved. In return for a hangover in the bottle, I've been given the keys to the kingdom. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.